Accession number 18463, reel 25.
Don Barrett, reel 25.
And we crossed the road, and the road dipped down into a little gully where the river should have been. But unfortunately, in Korea is a place where a river can be marked on the map. It can be dry in the winter when everything is frozen up or frozen over, and a flood in the summer. And this was dry. You could see all the pebbles quite clearly. And Rex said, the Rex is a platoon commander, said, hold on, there's no river. There's a river on my map. And I said, well, there you are. You can see it. There's the outline of the bed of the river. And I don't think he was too happy, but he took it. And we started off down the track. We'd gone about, I guess, 300 or 400 yards. It all seemed very quiet. And suddenly a burp gun, that's a Chinese submachine gun, burped away. You can always tell them, they're so easy to tell. Burped away on the ridge above us, and we all went to cover. And I called back to Rex, who was behind, and, you know, at the rear in the place where the platoon commander is supposed to be. And I said, I'll take a couple of guys up on the hill, find out who that is, and then I'll go along the ridge. And he said, no, press on as fast as you can on the track. And I thought, well, I wasn't too pleased about that. I don't think any of us were too pleased about that, because there's a burp up on the hill there and somebody fired it. Anyway, we press on, and eventually the track rises up a little. It's a proper graded track, and I would hazard a guess it had been done by the Rocks or the Americans to lead up to some position which they presumably had, but prior perhaps to the fighting. We eventually reached the end here. I guess it was a mile, might have been two, it's difficult to say. We're rising now above the stream bed, the dry stream bed, which is below us, and the hills are rising up on our right hand side, and left, of course. We're literally in a very, very vulnerable position. Came to the end, and it was like an enormous great bowl with some houses over on the left hand side, which were obviously not been touched, not been shelled or bombed or anything like that. And looking around, all around this bowl there were trenches. Looking through the glasses, I couldn't tell whether they were occupied. They looked as if they were not occupied, but the chances are that if they'd seen you, they wouldn't be actually hanging their heads out over the top. And to my astonishment, Rex ordered the patrol to off packs and get a rest. And I said, well, hold on, shouldn't we have a look up the hills? Or he said, yeah, that's okay. All the NCOs, except for a lance corporal, and we must have been two sections, because Bill Everett was there as well. And he said, if you take your boots off, these rubber boots, which you've got damn great blisters on it all over your feet now, and we'll go up to the top of this hill and just have a quick look, see what's going on up there. So we've got the silly situation where the patrol is laid out there with a one lance corporal resting, and all the NCOs and the platoon commander are whipping off their boots and in their plimsolls starting up this hill. And I said, look, I must get these in a defensive position. We can't just leave them down here. He said, all right, then get him to sort this out. And I don't suppose it was quite as casual as I'm making it sound now, but I mean, that's how it's remembered now. So I got Bethel to sort them out a little bit in some defensive, but I mean, they were too shattered actually to do very much. We started up the hill, got about halfway up, and suddenly something happened that made us think there might be somebody up there. Things were shining everywhere. We could see shiny tins everywhere. That's usually a sign of Americans, because they throw their refuse all over the place. And by this time, this was at the time when later the tins were painted a green colour. The first tins were silver and shone. The later ones were painted green and didn't quite so much. And we got to just below the crest and did the usual thing of whipping up there quickly. All the trenches were empty, but they were obviously Chinese trenches. There was no doubt whatsoever about that. And they'd been living on American rations and tossing the tins over the front, probably because they knew that would make it look like an American position. They cleared off, and the trenches then went off back down the ridgeline, in the direction where we'd heard the burp going. And looking out over the, a mile away, I guess it probably was, half a mile, couldn't really tell, there was a village burning. And I said to Rex, if you like, you go back down with a section, because there's only one way out of this now, is back down the track that we've come up. If you go down and take the rest of them out there, I'll take a couple of guys and we'll run along the top here and we'll make sure that there's no ambush, that burp gunner isn't waiting for us down there, but he wouldn't have that. So you can argue a little bit with an officer, but you can't insist. So we went off back down and got the chaps back into the, we got back into our boots again, got everybody up and off. And we went back the very way that we come out. And I must say I was very, very nervous because I expected to be caught. And I kind of understand why we didn't first investigate when we heard the burp and later why I wasn't allowed to go back and just check everything out. But anyway, we got back and nothing happened. So I guess he was right, and maybe I was wrong, but I still feel that we should have done it a little bit differently. Anyway, we then started to move across country. We now have come out of reserve, obviously, and a leading point. And we were up across, it was very, very difficult. Map reading was very difficult. I mean, the company commander who was responsible for this and the platoon commanders had a terrible job now because Korean maps, you look at them, are just a mass of contours, and it's just hills and valleys and dales and things. And we came across a place where the grass, it's fresh again now, incidentally. The winter's beginning to really clear away well. It's warming up just a trifle as well. And the grass had grown up there underneath the snow, and I guess it was 10, 15 yards across. A great column of men had marched across here, so we knew the Chinese had gone this way, and we expected, funny enough, to follow them and, you know, to try and find out where they'd gone. Didn't really want to follow them, but it's a way of things, isn't it? But unfortunately we didn't. We went on. And then, because it's the old fatal thing, the company commander's going the wrong way. So the front of the column turned round and past the back of the column, who tried not to make out that they thought it was a big joke, and didn't. The company commander was looking black as thunder, and we went off back, and I can't remember where we went to then, but we went on for quite a way until we came to one of the steepest cliffs I've ever seen, and we had to climb up this, and it was literally very, very steep, not rock climbing cliff, but very, very steep, and when you're loaded with arms and ammunition and stuff like that. And on the way up, I was beside the company commander, and he was obviously having a certain amount of difficulty, although he didn't have a pack or anything. We got to the top, and lo and behold, we're on a beautiful flat green plateau looking out for miles. In fact, we could see now, again, burning villages to our front, not the ones we'd seen before, but different burning villages, which was a fair sign that maybe the Chinese were withdrawing and burning things down. Or maybe the American aircraft were attacking and burning, we never know. But there, of course, sitting in a great big circle around this hill, is C Company, who've come up the easy slope, and the company commander saying, you're on our hill, and they're saying, no, you're not. You're on our hill, you clear off. So we cleared off. And we went down into the valley again and came up now another hill, which didn't, it looked a bit ominous, actually. And here the trees are, they're bushes rather than trees, and all the leaves were still on them, but dead. And I'm leading, my section's leading this time, but we've done the old thing with the platoons changing round, and we're now at point, my section's at point of the platoon, going up this track. And it was obvious that the Chinese have been there. I could smell them, I always can smell Chinese. I think it's correctly because I don't smoke, but I could always smell them. They have an oily smell, or an oily napalmy smell they have, and I could always tell. I knew they'd been there, and we're going up a bit fast because speed's about the only thing that may or may not keep you safe. And we burst through some trees, and they were wonderfully camouflaged trenches. We'd never seen them, And there they were. Had they been there, had there been any Chinese there, they could have let us come within a yard and we hadn't seen them. We burst through and got the other side. And they'd withdrawn, so it was a bit of luck in actual fact. And in fact, we were then withdrawn off of this hill, down into the valley, I presume because we'd been point platoon, and we went down in a protective arc around Company HQ. And my section, we dug in on a little low hillock, and we could see A Company over on one side, and presumably the other companies all round us. And my section was given a job of, in an emergency, we had to go over to a little wood about, I guess, 200 yards away and protect the flank and stand to each time, morning and evening. And we had to go over there and stand to in this little wood. Wonderful little wood it was. It was beautiful, soft, loamy soil. We didn't have to dig in. We just had to put the screen out, literally stopping anybody from dashing into Company HQ whilst Platoon HQ and the other two sections remained up on the top there. I couldn't see any possibility of anybody coming through because they'd have had to come through A Company. It was quite a nice little detachment. A stand-to, evening stand-to, I took my section out and we laid out in the amongst the trees there. And Rex came over to see us, the platoon commander came over to see us, and we had a jolly good yarn about air training at Shorncliffe and all the things that had happened and people that we liked and disliked, what have you. And funny enough, Stan 2 went on for a very long time, much longer than usual. I don't know why, I presume the order came from Battalion HQ when to stand down. And when the order to stand down came, Rex was still with me, chatting. And over on our platoon position, there was lots of rude noises and rude words and people shouting and bawling. But more important, there was no sound of the NCOs shutting them up, or the platoon sergeant, you know, and telling them to keep quiet. Rex took to his heels to get back there. And down at Company HQ, the company commander took it all very seriously. He thought he got a mutiny on his hands, we heard later, and he got his LMG group together, and we heard him say, cock your weapons, and they went over there, and there was a long wait and pause, and Rex was called down to, came back over to me and said, look, we're obviously in a lot of trouble over this, and company commander's not very pleased with us, and I'm going over to see him to see. He said, but we've got to stand here all night, 100%. And that, whilst everybody else stands down. And he said, I'm going over to see whether, as you weren't involved in it, whether he would allow your section to come back and get some rest. And to cut a long story short, he did. He did agree. I think he reluctantly agreed to that because, I mean, punishments such as this have got to really be collective. And we had a rather good night because when we got back, they gathered in loads of straw they were all going to kip in, and we got into this straw and had a smashing night. The following morning, of course, we did our thing again, went back over to our position, came back after stand down, and we were told that we had to parade. I can't remember the time, but it was, we'll say, 0900 or whatever it was. And the company commander was going to give us a good talking to him, which he did. A very, very, very severe talking to, and well deserved, of course, because as you pointed out, there'd been no attempt by any of the NCOs to stop this insubordination, and he wasn't too pleased with that at all. But of course, the main culprit, of course, was the platoon sergeant, who I'd heard later from the other NCOs, not only had he not stopped it, he'd been, in a sense, encouraging it by complaining about the company commander to everybody. Anyway, he vanished, went, never saw him again. So I guess that company commander probably got shot of him. I don't suppose that did his career much good, but he was an old, what we might call the old type of soldier. He had no idea whatsoever of active service in the field or dealing with men or anything like that. He was a waste of space, and we were glad to get rid of him. So we were without a platoon sergeant. We've only had one for a few days, and he's gone. And we get on now. We go on quite well now with Rex. Time passes on. And we one day we're point, one day we're not. And the final day, getting very close to closing up on the Chinese in their positions. And we did a clearing of a hill. It was only a clearing because there were no Chinese there. It would have been an attack if they had been there. And they were very close. I could smell them again. I kept saying to everybody, this isn't napalm, this is Chinese. Because napalm would be showing the burn marks and things like that. These are Chinese. And it seemed to stick to their... I think it might have been the napalm smell sticking to their uniforms, the thick padded uniforms. Or maybe it was their cooking, I don't know. You could all smell them. And we dug in just above a few houses and with a load of trenches in front of us. And I was told then to take a patrol down into this village and clear it. And I went down there with a patrol. And on the way down, we saw two young men and one woman walking along, all holding hands. They were smartly dressed in the period with black suits. The two men had black suits and the woman had a black skirt on and white top blouse, I suppose you'd call it, bun. They had short hair. And I called out to them to stop. They didn't. They just walked on. I called out again, shouted again. They never stopped. They just kept walking straight on. Now, I guess I should have shot them. I don't know. I really couldn't bring myself to shoot three unarmed civilians. They were absolutely unarmed, I knew. And I knew also that when they went over the top of this little ridge, they were going to walk straight into A Company, so it didn't really much matter anyway. And I had got it in me to shoot them, so I didn't shoot them, and they just walked over the hill, and we went off down the patrol. It's not very military, I suppose. I suppose you should have shot them and worried about it afterwards, but I could never bring myself to do things like that. Anyway, we went down to the village and found a house with a middle-aged lady and her husband there, and went through all the old motions of, you know, signals and things, and he pointed out she was sick. But then that was a natural thing, because obviously they don't want their women folk molested, and she was smiling and what have you. And we left them, went off a bit on, and found a house. It was like two houses joined together, and there was a couple, well, I should think two, maybe three families in there, quite friendly. And we left them, went off up the ridge where all the trenches and dugouts were, and examined all of them. They had wonderful dugouts, they did, the Chinese, logged. It's about 6-inch log roof, I guess, something like that, soil on the top. Always very, very small, which of course makes it even safer. And the old smell was there, they hadn't been long away. And you never find much laid around after they've gone, because, you know, equipment and what have you is very valuable. There were one or two bits of very, very worn clothing thrown about, but nothing else. Went off back to the company and reported. And the man of the older man and his wife, the man insisted on coming back up with us, and we took him up the top there, and John Swarbrick was up there, which means, of course, thinking now, that means he must have been second in command of B Company. He wasn't MTO at this time; he was second in command of B Company, because he'd come up with the porters. And the chap tried to shake hands with him, and John would never do that. And I said, well, his wife's down the bottom there, she's sick and he's looking after her, whatever, any sort of friendly character. And John said, well, that's all right. He said, he's one of my porters now. Oh, I said, but his wife's sick, you know, you're going to leave her alone down there. Can't help that, he said, I want porters. So we grabbed him and took him off as a porter. I felt terrible about this. There's four ladies down the bottom there. Her husband's gone, if he was her husband, of course. And, you know, she isn't going to know anything about it. So I thought about this for quite a while. And I thought, well, it's no good asking if I can go down and tell her, because you can't have people wandering about all over the place. And it sort of bugged me just a little bit. And I thought, well, I've got to go down there and try and warn her that he won't be back for a bit. So I left my stand on the parapet as if I was there, the trench and my equipment. No, I kept my musketry order on, the rest of the equipment, and decided to go down. I was just armed with a carbine bayonet. I think it was a bit of bravado here as well, because I'll be honest, since Hill 112, I was beginning to wonder whether I was still as brave as I thought I was, and I think it was a little bit of bravado in it. Anyway, I went off down there and found her, but I don't think she had the faintest idea what I was trying to tell her. And I gave her a tin of food, a sea ration, and I was coming back, and I met a funny enough, a chap from A Company. He shouldn't have been down there, but he wandered over the hill, and he was armed, thank goodness. And we went along. We had another look in this big place where all the people were, the double house, and we poked our head in the door, and they were all sitting down around a long table, and they called us in. They insisted that we sat down with them and had some of their meal. Well, we did the old usual thing. We had a bowl of rice, but we wouldn't eat the rest of it because they were so short of food. But one of the wonderful things about the Korean people was always that when you met them in these situations, and I'll take into account the fact that there's fear in them and they want to keep in with you, but they were always so friendly, and they always insisted that you had some of their food. And when you haven't got a lot of food, and we had sufficient for our needs, we were always hungry, but we had sufficient for our needs, and they didn't. I always think it's a wonderful thing, really, that they were prepared to share it with us. And as I say, we had the rice, we had the bowl of rice, traditional, and then excused ourselves and went back up again. And that evening, Rex came down and said he was taken out of patrol, and he was taken out of my section, officer patrol, this was. And that our job was to, and we could just see the tops of a high ridge, and it was thought to be occupied by the Chinese. Now, I'd never known this until now. I thought there wasn't anybody there at all, you know, it was an empty sort of place. And in fact, during the morning, the CO had come up. He'd come back from leave, incidentally. After being commanding the brigade for a time, he'd been sent on leave. And he came up, and we all sat in a great big hollow, and he talked to us about his leave. And I always remember that he said that he was sitting in a conference room. He'd been invited to some American conference. And he was sitting there, and they said, "Oh, there's a very notable English officer here now who is going to talk to us." And he looked around to see who this officer was, and he suddenly realised it was him. So he went out the front and gave him one of his off-the-cuff talks. One suspects that he apparently said to them that information was the thing, and that we never got enough information, or he's talking about himself, of course, now. I mean, the officer never got enough information. And the chap who was controlling this thing said to one of the staffers, "Make a note of that, make a note of that, make sure they all get the information they have." And he eventually apparently saw MacArthur, and he said the only thing he could remember about him was that he had long, thin, bony hands with veins, blue veins sticking up, and that was his memory of MacArthur. And he also said, and he denies this now completely, he cannot remember this whatsoever, but he told us that, and I've talked to a number of people, and we all remember this, he told us that he got the ribbon for the Korean citation back down at B Echelon, and as soon as permission was given for us to wear it, every man who was on the NACTOM, that is, I mean, C Company weren't, but the rest of us were, every man would get this medal ribbon and he'd be able to wear it. And we thought, oh, that's great. But, as of course, it was disallowed, and we never did wear it, and have never been allowed to wear it. And he can't remember that at all, but when we go on a little bit, you'll realise perhaps why that was. And I think he went off from us and apparently collapsed completely. And the adjutant thought he was dying, in actual fact. And I don't know what it was. I mean, it was... maybe it was a nervous breakdown, I don't know. But he was shortly after that, he was evacuated to Japan, and unfortunately never came back to join us, which was a very sad thing. And very shortly after that, of course, Brigadier Code, who'd returned, he left us to become Major General of a division in Germany. So we'd lost our two linchpins, for want of a better word. Anyway, we would have to go out on this patrol. Rex tells me that they believe these hills, which you can just see in the distance, are occupied. And I couldn't believe it, because we've been here, for nearly 12 hours, I guess, 24 hours, whatever, and we hadn't known that the Chinese are that close. We go off on the patrol. We have to go down a... it sounded like a metal drogue, but I mean, because it's pretty hard, it does sound, and the old boots resound. We should have always, today, of course, they have rubber soles, don't they? And the Americans had rubber sole boots, but ours, we had 13 studs in each boot and toe and heel caps. And they just sounded so loud, frightened the life out of you as you walked along. So you tried to get on the edge of the road, which is, of course, is always a bit dangerous because it could be mined. And we eventually went down into this valley. And the place where the Chinese were expected to be, thought to be, was very, very steep, very, very steep, and covered in small trees and bushes and things like that. We got down to the bottom there, and Rex said, well, we've got to go along this way here for about 200 or 300 yards and get up the hill. So we went up as quietly as we could, up the road for about 200 yards, I guess, might have been 100, and stopped. And he said, we're on a patrol now, you'll appreciate, right, with the expecting the enemy to be above us. And he said, I can't go up that hill. So I said, what do you mean you can't go up there? He said, my back is playing me up and I can't climb up the hill. Will you go up? I said, yeah. I wasn't too pleased, I must add. And I'm sure that there was a whispered, a few whispered rude words said at that moment of time. And I said to him, well, all right. I'm not going up with me, Stan. You take me, Stan. Give me your 38, because all I've got to do is fire around, and you'll know you're in trouble, and you've got to get out. You won't be able to wait for us. Well, I was going to take a man with me. And, you know, it'll give you the word that you've got to get out quick. And he said, but I've only got one round in me, 38. I said, you must be joking. Here we are in active service. He's got a 38 pistol, one round. Hasn't got any other sort of weapon. I was getting a little bit miffed by this time. Anyway, I said, I'll have it. And I took it. And we had to crawl up this hill, literally on our stomachs, pulling ourselves up. I don't know how the other chap managed it quite, because he had a rifle and he got it slung across his back. Got to within near the top, within the, I guess, 10 yards of the actual crest. And we could see it was lined with dugouts and trenches all the way along there, seeing them as clear as you like. And there wasn't anything to do. We've got to now find out if they're occupied. So we give that the old last bit, you know, the old dash up to the top. And dash up, and all the ones in front of us are empty. So I left him there, and I went off down to the right, examining them all. And they're all empty. Every one of us are empty, but that smells there again, and they've not been empty for very long. And it was too dark to see how far they extended, but they seemed to go on forever. And looking across the valley, again, it's very, very dark, and we couldn't see what had happened over the other side, except that the very, very steep slope there was going up to a crest, and it looked just like shale is about the only way I can describe it, but there wasn't anything else. Went back down again, gave Rex his pistol and took my stem. We went back and presumably he reported. I was a bit displeased with what had happened, actually, but never mind. Anyway, the next day we were ordered forward again, and we were to occupy this ridge, which we did, without any effect whatsoever. There was nobody up there, but these trenches went for miles. And you could see what the Chinese had done. They'd expected us to come along the road like the Americans always did. And they'd lined the road with trenches on either side. And they would have slaughtered anybody who came down the road. But of course, when we arrived overland,